Oh, Portland?
Hello? Hello? 1, 2, 3.
Baby, you understand me now.
Greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO, Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening the understanding of the institution of incarceration. Today, we're here with Saudia Durant with the Abolitionist Law Center and a bunch of other great projects, too. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks so much for having me on.
Right on. Thanks for being on. Let's get right into it. Can you talk a bit about how you got involved with the different organizing that you do and also just give some explanation of where you're located?
Cool, yes. So I'm Saudia, she, her pronouns. I'm an organizer, a racial justice organizer with the Abolitionist Law Center here based in Philadelphia. We're a statewide organization that provides litigation support and organizing support for families who deal with the real lived experiences of prison abuse and torturous conditions. And we do this organizing work to support the networks of grandmothers, mothers, aunties, brothers, sisters, families who have been deeply committed from their experiences in imagining what a world would look like if we didn't have to use prisons or punishment or violence or torture as a false means to hold people accountable. And we do this work by doing and creating safe spaces for families to grieve, to talk about the conditions that they go through, to do deep political development and examination of the kind of conditions that often Black and Brown and Indigenous communities have to face and are unfortunately overexposed to through the nature of white supremacy in our country. And just knowing that prisons and cages that warehouse people are a huge vehicle for white supremacy's enforcement. We've been doing this work over the last several decades of centering the lives of people who deal with these conditions to lead the movements for having models of rehabilitation and accountability and transformation through means of connection rather than means of separation and isolation. So definitely excited to be joining in this nearly, I believe this year officially marks 20 years of doing this organizing work with the Human Rights Coalition, which some of the co-founders helped to launch the Abolitionist Law Center in 2012. So really excited and gracious to be a part of this work. And I also see it as a direct correlation of a lot of amazing organizing that happens here locally in Philadelphia. I also come from the background of youth and labor organizing in Philly, working with a lot of young people to think about what does it mean to have liberation work within the context of education. So I've spent the last few years, about 3 to 4 years, of working with young people in high schools throughout Philadelphia, where we examine very similar conditions within prison that connect very much to the type of conditions that we see also inside of schools, especially schools that house mostly BIPOC youth. So it's definitely been transformative seeing a few different lenses of justice work and seeing how they connect and relate into this broader movement for liberation.
The term abolition or abolitionist is not new to history at all, and not that the word went anywhere. However, it does seem like it's kind of backed by popular demand and has helped to be part of the platform in talking about all the different things that you're discussing, from mass incarceration, youth disenfranchisement, global imperialism. Can you explain a little bit more what it means today in that sense, and how it's changing and empowering people in different communities.
Yeah, I think that's an amazing point to uplift, and a great question to frame this context, right? Because as we know, I think that's a very true statement that the term abolitionist has been reframed in a way where it feels very new or very suggestive sometimes when it's displaced from its historical context of knowing that slave catchers, you know, now exist with union contracts or uniforms. I think it's very interesting how often history gets framed in a way where it gets removed entirely or disconnected from all the different material elements that have, I think, helped people to evolve, right? Like as our society has evolved away from more of the explicitly barbaric approaches of socially controlling or disempowering or disenfranchising different communities, Black and brown or third world people, I think is that evolution from slave plantations to prison systems and societies, I think there is more than enough reason for our communities to be very sharpened in seeing the connection between abolition in the context of ending a slave system that made it legalized and morally fit to have a caste system where Black and Indigenous folks bear the labor and the blood of establishing our country and were exploited, right? I think it's really important, and often what I see, especially within youth organizing work, right, is that you have so many young people who attend schools where their history is completely sanitized and whitewashed and liberalized to ignore, right, or if not to ignore, to be mistaught and to be miseducated about what their role in society has been. I spent a lot of years working with young people after school, just talking about things that they learned during the day in their classroom week to week, things that they learned exploring their neighborhood or their family networks. And I think what I would often see is that, right, we all carry within us this natural connection to our ancestors and to a need to feel seen within the Black resistance struggle, right, of seeing how we exist in the world constantly being actively ignored, or being shamed or being forgotten. And I think often, unfortunately, because we have a society now that is so quote unquote technologically advanced or industrialized, where a lot of the things or the skills that we have are in relationship to the internet, to social media, to objects, to commercialized things. I think often because of the way that we're socialized in capitalism, we're socialized to differentiate between the conditions that our communities dealt with decades and generations ago, but have so much clear overlap. And knowing that so much of our communities are forced each and every day to be exploited, are forced to struggle as the poor or working class, to have to literally survive from scraps and crumbs of barely livable wages, and having to exploit ourselves to support the rich and the elite, and to know that if we choose actively not to engage with that system or to defy it, that we're often met with state-sponsored violence, state-protected violence, but then are blamed or ghettoized when our communities engage with violence with one another from the conditions that we're forced under. I think it's really important, and it's interesting how often the role of policing and the role of prisons are seen completely separate of the initial context of abolition being about removing enslaved people and enslaved people having the self-independence and the self-empowerment to free themselves. I think it's very interesting how often that gets completely lost. That loss, right, is a product of the society that we live in, where we're force-fed to believe in the fairy tales of who our presidents are and what they did in fighting for, you know, liberty and justice, but knowing that that justice did not mean anything for Black folks, for Indigenous folks, for queer and trans folks, for women, And I think it's really important as we shift right into this moment that we're in now, where the term abolition or phrases like defund the police have become a lot more sensationalized, where people now have an open ear to things that they were not ready to hear. Maybe certain things they weren't ready to hear decades ago and are now open because of the constant cases of murder, right? Legalized murder and legalized death sentences in the streets. I think it's really important that in order for us to actually have a struggle where we can see a win to shift our material conditions and to identify the clear contradictions in our society, that we do not remove the fight that we're in now from the fight that freedom fighters have fought for continuously, and seeing our innate responsibility for liberation and freedom and resistance.
All that work that you do highlights this intersectionality of all these different struggles that are local, regional, national, and international. And as you mentioned, we're in this kind of hyper technological 21st century. And while a lot of people are overly tuned into what some idiot has to tweet every day, you know, or, you know, basically, you know, these kind of different info media wars that are going on, then y'all take to the streets and are doing amazing work and recentering the fact that that's happening, and also reframing it as you're talking about, also in reframing it, because most of the time so much of activism and protests are looked at as, you know, people misusing the terms, rather, riot and things of that nature. And so can you talk more about, yeah, that work that really is going on the ground, and how guided it actually is, and also that it, you know, it doesn't get really the attention that it deserves in the national milieu of things?
I think locally here, there have been a series and a multitude of different organizing tactics or development work that has happened that often does not get seen or uplifted. And it's funny, it kind of reminds me of that quote, if a tree falls in a forest and no one's around to hear it, did it actually fall? And I think it's interesting kind of seeing different sort of layers of work happening in the city and different layers of sort of engagement. For the last few years, there has been extraordinary racial justice, gender justice, labor justice, environmental justice, racial justice work happening locally. You have young people in the streets in many organizations in Philadelphia, from Philadelphia Student Union to the Youth Art and Self-Empowerment Project. So many youth organizations, Youth United for Change, Viet Lead, who all have been fighting, right, for decades for having accountable, equitable, an informative education that really empowers young people to not only feel seen or to feel well-resourced or prepared for the world, but to also have access to education that transforms and empowers them to do the liberation work when they understand the contradictions that they see in the test in their textbooks, white supremacy and colonialism setting a very oppressive tone, and who has access to power and who doesn't. There has been extraordinary work done with young people in different groups fighting against toxic schools, fighting for anti-racist teaching, fighting for educators and processes to be able to attend schools that actually have resources versus just allowing the status quo to unfold, where you see often Black and brown poor working class families having to go to schools where the water is questionable because of its cancerous toxins in it, or the textbooks that they had being from nearly 20, 30 years ago, to not having working computer labs, to having lack of healthy and clean and sustainable school environments, to having police and metal detectors and bars on the windows where children go. Young people have been organizing, recognizing those contradictions, while also having a school district that has air conditioning and folks employed making nearly $200,000 to $300,000 a year in salary, leadership that doesn't have a background in education or isn't centered in community empowerment but is trained in how to run a government or how to run an office and have no connection to actually creating community controlled and informed schools. It's been amazing seeing within that realm of work of education justice framework, also seeing a lot of amazing work for communities fostering Black liberation education and empowerment, seeing MOVE in the last few years, fighting to get all of their family members freed, fighting to inform the communities of all of the horrific things that our local government, the war that our local government has enacted on communities, on children, on folks daring to say that they refuse to align themselves with city leadership that has white supremacist policies or initiatives and culture. It's been amazing seeing prison abolitionists and organizing groups fighting to make sure that there are safe networks of folks who can make calls to the 24 different state prisons, constantly checking in on their loved ones, making sure that water is running, that food is clean, that folks have access to PPE, to trying to get an end to solitary confinement, and knowing that these are things that we shouldn't have to fight to have, right? These are human rights that people deserve to have, but knowing that if that's what it takes to make sure that our folks are protected, then that's the pledge and the commitment that we take until we have the kind of abolitionist world that we want to have, until we have a world where all identities and communities have what they need. I think that's what it looks like here locally. I think Philadelphia and Pennsylvania in general has a lot to win and a lot of reason to fight for these things. We're like the birthplace in the country of the punishment system with Eastern State Penitentiary built. A lot of the experiments of abuse and torture inside of prisons that we see all initiated here, or at least we're one of the major cities, right, that have secured this recipe to continue waging war on people. So I think there's just a lot of beautiful organizing that happens here. I think, unfortunately, we see often what makes it to the headline or to the front page is just politicians or presidential elections or political work that's being done that, yeah, engages people to participate, you know, in their democracy, but doesn't actually empower them to transform or to assess and criticize the government that they live in. And that's sort of the shift that I hope we get to see more people being mobilized to join the mass line in a lot of these justice areas of work.
For folks just tuning in, you are hearing Prison Pipeline, and we're airing from the studios of KBOO Portland, and we're here with Saudia Durant with the Abolitionist Law Center, talking about all the amazing organizing that's happening in Pennsylvania, among other places. And can you give us a little overview of what the prisons look like in the state of Pennsylvania? There's quite a few, and people might not be familiar with this. And also to just kind of mention too that, you know, there are several notable political prisoners who are still currently incarcerated, and some other folks who were out now that were also wrongly incarcerated political prisoners as well. And so kind of what that landscape looks like.
Sure, I can do my best to drop as much info. Like most states, Pennsylvania has a very complex prison system that gives us much reason to continue mobilizing and bringing more people into this movement work. There's about 24 different state prisons across Pennsylvania. We have over 40,000 people in the state correctional institution prison system. There's about another roughly over 30,000 people just sitting inside of different county jails across Pennsylvania. A large portion of these are folks who haven't even been sentenced or convicted of a crime, but unfortunately are not able to afford bail because we know the cash bail system is really just a ransom system for poor Black and Indigenous folks and marginalized folks. We know that the prison conditions are especially heinous and inhumane and horrific. We know this to be very true, especially under the last year and a half of COVID pandemic conditions as well. So we get letters constantly from different prisoners at different facilities who share traumas that they experience constantly. Everything from being abused by correctional officers, being harassed, being intimidated, having horrible things said to them, being told to carry out certain acts, or they'll be violated, or they'll experience violence if they don't follow specific orders for COs. I've heard stories of being told that prisoners have had to fight each other to entertain correctional officers, and if they didn't, they would be sent to the hole. I've read letters of folks writing about experiencing severe mental health trauma from being inside of solitary cells, a room where you, a very small square room, where you're expected to eat, defecate, and sleep all within the same room, often sitting in the dark with no working air, no working heat in the wintertime, food that's often stale, disgusting looking, cold. I've read stories of, you know, cafeteria attendants coughing on food as they're handing it off to prisoners, not wearing masks, not wearing gloves. Very horrible, unsanitary conditions, to even the loss of human connection and how it affects many folks, right, who make it 1 to 2 hours outside feeling fresh air on their face, who are only given a 15-minute phone call each day talking to a loved one, and sometimes who don't even get that. 15 minutes may become 5 minutes if your CO is having a bad day, or if they hear you complaining about things or seeking help, that 15-minute phone call could just become non-existent. I've heard stories of families losing visitation time, losing being able to see their loved one and check in on them during COVID. Lots and lots of horrific stories. I often hear stories of prisoners being pushed to self-harm themselves or to commit suicide because of the conditions that they have to deal with, the isolation that they feel from not being able to talk to anyone who cares about them, the deep remorse that they have for the mistake or whatever action that they took or offense that they took that resulted in them being in that facility, and knowing that unfortunately, because Pennsylvania is one of only about 4 states left in the United States that mandates life without the possibility of parole, or what we reframe as death by incarceration, right? Because we know a sentence of life without parole is really just asking you to die a slow social death. A slow social death because you start to lose the skills that most of us wanna have when we're able to connect with loved ones or when we're able to have relationships with people. It also happens when you have very little access to resources, access to a library, access to some sort of skill or hobby or something that allows your brain and your heart to still function fully. We hear a lot of just horrible and disparaging stories from a lot of folks on the inside, a lot of people who, some of which are fortunate enough to maybe have one loved one or family member that they can still write to, but many of which who often don't, that only have organizations or coalitions who believe completely in the possibility for people to be not judged by the worst mistake that they made, or maybe a mistake that wasn't even made, maybe a mistake that was the product of a mistake on the state side, because we also know that there are plenty of people wrongfully convicted or unjustly convicted and sentenced. So there's a lot of conditions that we often deal with that propel us to keep moving this work forward, because we know that no human being should be thrown away, that no human life should be treated worse than an animal or like an animal. And we know that the process of the state using violence and using torture and depositing humans into this political and social black hole where they can't be found or connected to will not make us have anti-violent communities. It will not make us have empowering communities. And as a country that imprisons more people than anywhere else in the world, but is probably one of the least safe countries to live in, I think we see a deep correlation between the two. And that's the framework of why we do this work.
So folks should check out the website. It's www.abolitionistlawcenter.org. Again, that's abolitionistlawcenter.org to get more information about all the great work that organization is doing. And you're working with so many different projects as well. And I know that there's been some kind of recent updates for ongoing work around the cases of Mumia and Russell Maroon Schoetz. Folks are probably more familiar with Mumia Abu-Jamal's case in general. and maybe less familiar with Maroon Schultz. Can you just briefly just kind of mention any kind of updates that are going on for happenings in your area?
Most definitely. So we know Mamiya and Maroon are both freedom fighters, right? A part of the amazing early Black resistance organizing from the 60s and the 70s. We understand that they both represent pivotal organizations that have allowed us to have the culture that we have now of continuing the fight to free all social and political prisoners and to transform our society. We understand that for both Mamiya and Maroon, and I'll start with Maroon specifically, who is an elder who is 77 years old, who has spent nearly the last 50 years inside of a SCI in Pennsylvania, and a lot of that time spent inside of solitary confinement and deplorable and horrible, you know, by many measures, almost spirit-breaking conditions, right? That he has had a lot of unfortunate health issues in the past few months. He contracted and tested positive for COVID around January earlier this year. He has stage 4 colon cancer and has had to suffer in quarantine inside of the prison. We understand that his condition is not a suitable condition for any human being, but especially not for someone who is aging, someone who is elderly, and someone who is vulnerable, right? Someone who has been in prison since 1970, right? Someone who, by many different measures, has overcome so much that has been put against him by those who have intentionally wanted to break our freedom fighters on the inside. What we understand now is that we're continuing to try to work for his compassionate release. We understand that he fits a lot of the different protocols that would exist for someone who is vulnerable, who should be able to spend their last few years, right, on the outside with their family members and with their loved ones. We know that the recidivism rate drops significantly for aging and elderly prisoners. And that his case, like many other cases, right, should be more than enough for him to be issued clemency or compassionate release so that he can enjoy, you know, the time that he deserves with his family and with his loved ones. So we demand and call for his immediate release of freedom, and the same for all other aging prisoners. Very similarly with Mamiya, he has also suffered a lot of significant health ailments that has overcome them significantly. He's been diagnosed previously with congestive heart failure, with diabetes, with liver psoriasis, and most recently COVID-19. He is at SCI Mahanoy in Schuylkill County and has been recently overcoming open heart surgery, which he experienced a few weeks ago, and fortunately had a very safe and healthy recovery. And we know that, right, the health and the progress that our political prisoners have been able to significantly overcome, right, has also come from the fact that there are so many movements of communities saying nationally and internationally that we will continuously fight for our freedom fighters to be released, that we will not stop pushing for them to be freed and for all political prisoners in the US to be freed. And we understand that that is the least that we can do in terms of giving them the energy and hopefully the power and the support to continue fighting until they're able to be released.
Right on. Well, thanks so much for all the amazing updates and all the great work that you're doing. Again, folks, check out the abolitionistlawcenter.org. And you've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Big thanks to our guest and Prison Pipeline Collective member Karen James for editing and production. Bring them on.
Si no te aprueban. adentro. A mí me gusta estar en la arena, bañarme en el mar sin razón, sin problema. Estar sentada sin hacer nada, mirando de lejos y estar relajada. No te preocupes si no te aprueban cuando te critiquen. Tú solo di. Soy yo.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault. This week, we present a special program to celebrate the launch of the Pacifica Radio Archives' first book, published by City Lights Books, Redefining Black Power, Reflections on the State of Black America, edited by From the Vault collaborator and BBC Radio 5 Live host, Joanne Griffith. This book utilizes the Pacifica Radio Archives' classic civil rights and black power recordings, such as W.E.B. Du Bois, Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Audre Lorde, as a context for the new conversation on the state of black America with contemporary educators, activists, and philosophers.